Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
There's compelling evidence that the law enforcement response to the attack at Robb Elementary was an abject failure and antithetical to everything we've learned over the last two decades since the Columbine massacre.
That is Steve McCraw, the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to a Tuesday, a little bit of honestly provocative talk, and I'm glad to have you involved. Things are not looking so good as we learn more about the worst school shooting in the last decade, the one that happened in Uvalde, Texas, the one that involved the murders of 19 children and two teachers. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me on a Tuesday. And glad to have you join me on the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. If you'd like to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails right to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. Take a moment, if you don't mind, to vote in our Twitter poll. Doesn't cost anything, might be habit forming, but that's okay. You can find it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. And if you, like me, are not a big fan of Twitter until Elon Musk takes over, you can find the question and vote there on my website at LarsLarson.com. But the latest we've heard about Uvalde and the school shooting there raises so many questions. And I know that some of you are going to say, but Lars, you always back the blue. I do back the blue. And I always add the caveat, unless they break the law or break the rules. And in this case, the job of police in every single community in America is to maintain public safety, to save lives that are in jeopardy. Well, that's the problem in the Uvalde shooting. And it's a lesson we've got to learn, because I thought we learned this lesson about 20 years ago after the Columbine High School shooting, where there were kids and teachers trapped inside a building. And the police waited outside till they had all their ducks in a row, till they had all the gear and all the equipment and all the organization, till they had a plan. And after that one, I can't tell you how many police officers have told me, because I've never been a cop. They've said to me, Lars, we learned the lesson. The lesson is, when you have a shooting going on, you come to that active shooter situation. You go into the building. And even if you're walking past bleeding victims on the ground, you go right past them to the source of the danger, and you eliminate the danger. If needs be, you shoot the bad guy or bad guys to death. You put them on the ground. You take them into custody, whatever you have to do. And yet, for some reason, that didn't happen in Uvalde, Texas. 20 years of having learned the lesson, but in Uvalde, Texas, that's not what happened. Police put the lives of officers before the lives of children during the Uvalde school shooting. Now, that's not me saying that. That comes from Steve McGraw, the guy you heard at the first part of this segment. He is director of the Texas Department of Public Safety. He sat in front of a state Senate committee hearing investigating last month's mass killing. Listen to what he had to say next.
I don't believe, based on the information that we have right now, that that door was ever secured. In fact, I have great reason to believe it wasn't secured. The door was unsecured, and we've gone back and checked in our interviews, and did anybody touch the door and try it? You know, how about, you know, do you need a key? Well, one of the things they teach you in active training, I'm sure that one of the experts can talk about it, how about trying the door and see if it's unlocked?
Yeah, that's Steve McCraw, the director of public safety for the entire state of Texas. Now, think about this. He's telling these the people on this Senate committee, they never even bothered to try the door. And yet, for the better part of the last month, since the shooting last month in Texas, we've been hearing, well, the police officers had to wait till they got the gear on the scene. It turns out they had the gear on the scene. They had to wait till there were enough officers. There were enough officers. And then the argument was, no, they had to wait until somebody brought a master key. And here's what Steve McGraw did. He did a minute-by-minute breakdown of what happened during that entire incident that, as I said, took the lives of 19 school children. The timeline he gave described how law enforcement officials kept waiting to pursue the gunman inside the classroom, waiting for a key to the room when the door was not locked. He says 3 minutes after that man walked into the school with a gun, Several police officers were also inside. Several had rifles. Within 19 minutes, they had a protective ballistic shield inside. That's one of the pieces of gear they said they were waiting for. But they waited outside. They stood right outside the classroom door. Why? Because they were waiting for a key. Take a listen to his next answer to this Senate committee.
What we would conclude from your testimony today would be that no one tried the door. There was a lot of time waiting for a key, of which a dysfunctional door was never locked because the shooter was able to walk in and, as you say, go back and forth.
Moreover, though, the point is you don't have to wait for a key and shouldn't have to wait forever for a key.
No, you don't have to wait for a key because he pointed out they had the equipment on hand, including a Halligan tool that's used by both firefighters and cops to enter a door, even if the door is locked solid. And as he put it, the only thing stopping a hallway full of dedicated officers from entering rooms 112 and 111 was the on-scene commander who said, do not go in. He calls it an abject failure. Listen to as he describes what they could have done with a breaching team if needs be.
Even if you're part of the breaching team, we've gone back and talked to them, and they've been led to believe that it's locked. Even they, you know, when you go back and talk to them, they didn't try the door. They took the key. As you can do the key, it'll open it, okay? Whether it's locked or unlocked, it will take the throw and put it back into the door, and you move it, and you can walk, and you go right in.
You go right in. And that's what they didn't do. They got the shields. They got the rifles. They didn't even try the door to see if it was unlocked. They stood outside. Some reports over the last month say they were waiting for a master set of keys to enter the classrooms. They had a Halligan tool. That's like an axe, a combination of axe and pry bar. It arrived 8 minutes after the shooter entered the building. They waited for far longer than that. And I guess the bottom line to all of this, for all of us non-cops, we trust that the police will be on the scene as quickly as they can. And then in the case of a mass shooting, whether it's in a school, in a supermarket, whether it's in a shopping mall, that they will go in and they will go immediately to the threat and eliminate the threat so that aid can be provided to those people who are wounded. In this case, the wait was literally fatal for some of the people. There have been at least a few reports in the last month since the shooting in Uvalde, Texas, that say that there were people who bled out while they were waiting for the police to go in. It sounds as though it was simply a lack of will on the part of the incident commander, who it sounds like never should have been in charge of this at all. And what are the lessons we're going to learn going forward? Perhaps that there has to be an absolute urgent need to go into any one of those shootings. And then in that case, while we don't ask police officers to go and do their job and die, we don't ask them to die. But is there a request that at times they need to put their safety second and the safety of innocent victims first? As Steve McCraw put it, the officers had weapons, the children did not. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, and I want to say a few things about a congressman who's a multimillionaire. He doesn't want to give you a cut in the cost of your gasoline.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
Brought to you by Handyman Maintenance Remodeling. You can find them at hmrservices.net. That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Earl Blumenauer has never had a real job in his life. He went from college to the state legislature to the county commission to the city council. And for the last quarter of a century, Earl Blumenauer has been in the House of Representatives. I think that he takes that job for granted these days because of the nasty way that he views the needs of his constituents. Americans now pay record prices for gasoline and diesel fuel, and most of them have no choice about it. They need that fuel to get to work and to do their jobs, unlike Earl, who rides a bicycle to work every day. The White House is now considering suspension of the federal gasoline tax. Now, I would agree, I'd be the first to agree, that it's only going to make a small difference, just over 18 cents a gallon. But when you're paying $5 a gallon or more, on its way to $6 at some point, every little bit helps. Blumenauer just came out in staunch opposition to such a gas tax holiday, even though it's being proposed at the White House, which is headed by his Democrat buddy, Joe Biden. He even wrote a letter to President Biden calling on the president to reject the idea because, get this, it would, in Earl's words, blow a hole in the transportation budget. Maybe the congressman who's become a multimillionaire while feeding at the public trough for all these decades, maybe he doesn't realize that. But fuel costs are blowing a hole in the family budgets of the citizens he represents. But apparently to Blumenauer, who is in a very blue congressional district and has almost no chance of losing this sweet gig in an election, he cares more about the government's budget than he does about yours. And by the way, I'd always be glad to take a naysayer call from somebody who likes Earl Blumenauer or thinks he does a good job of representing the citizens. Naysayers always go first at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And Kurt Piper writes in, Lars, adding insult to injury, a suspension of the gas tax with its 18-cent reduction will only work once. Only once, then get swallowed up in the next increase. What I'm posting on Facebook to your Earl Blumenauer commentary, the one thing I don't understand with this gas tax suspension is, what's the difference? The price of the pump has doubled in a year, and there's no sign of it slowing, just as there's no sign of inflation slowing down. That 18 cents a gallon will be swallowed up as if it never existed. And then when things settle down, the tax will be reinstated, probably increased, and we'll feel that we're being worked over by the administration again. Once again, we'll have brought it upon ourselves, signed Kurt. Kurt, I'm going to have to honestly disagree with you. If the government is told you can't charge that fee for a period of time, then the bureaucracies that are supported by that, and I would point out that almost 40% of the federal gas tax does not go to roads and highways and freeways and bridges. It goes to mass transit. They might have to say, we're going to have to live within our means, just like the people we represent. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Rogue Conveyors. Go Rogue.
Now, before I tell you the details on today's grill, because it could apply to almost every government in the Pacific Northwest, let me ask you a question. Do you have a friend? And maybe it's a good friend. And the good friend is the kind of person who, when he has some money that comes unexpectedly, maybe a bonus from work or the sale of something, and all of a sudden he's got cash in his pocket and he's spending like a drunken sailor. Or maybe in a way that it would embarrass a drunken sailor. This is the way most of the governments behave. And let me back that up. The city of Seattle, in this case, I'm going to point this out, their own budget director says these pandemic funds in some ways have exacerbated this pattern of, oh, we have some one-time money, so we're going to invest in an ongoing thing. This is a guy by the name of Ben Noble. He was the budget director 3 years ago for the city of Seattle. So he's part of the government, but he said, look, this is a problem. It would be a lot like, and I had to think on this one for a moment, if you had a friend and he had some one-time money, say $500 or $1,000, and he said, well, I've really needed to replace the tires on my car. I'll replace the tires on my car with that $1,000. That's not an ongoing need. That's one-time use of one-time money. If, on the other hand, your friend who just got $1,000 in found money, but he's not expecting to get another $1,000 in a month or 6 months or a year. You say, what are you going to do with that? He says, I'm going to go buy a new car. You say, you're going to buy a new car for $1,000? Oh, no, I'm going to use the $1,000 as my down payment. If you said to your friend, well, aren't you going to create an ongoing obligation, you know, that monthly car payment you have to make for the next 3 years or 4 years or 6 years, whatever it happens to be? He says, oh, yeah. I said, well, how are you going to do that? You're using one-time money to create a new obligation. What has the city of Seattle done? The same thing that all the other knuckleheaded governments in the Pacific Northwest have done. They had, during the pandemic, $128 million in one-time federal relief. They also had almost a quarter of a billion, $231 million, from a brand new payroll tax called Jumpstart. And what did they do with the money? They used it to patch some budget holes and also to create brand new programs that are ongoing expenses. So guess what happens? They go from feast to famine. They go from all this extra money, almost a third of $1 billion in one-time or brand-new money. They create a bunch of new obligations. Do you know what the city of Seattle is looking at right now? For next year, they are $117 million short between the revenues they expect to collect and the money they expect to spend. They are just like that knucklehead who took his $1,000 bonus and then went out and bought a car, put the down payment down, and obligated himself to years and years and years of money he doesn't have and cannot afford. And what will these jokers do? They'll come to you and me, the taxpayers. I don't live in the city of Seattle, but the city of Portland is no different. City of Vancouver, not much different. They will go out and create brand new obligations that they have to pay over the years, and then they'll come to the voters and say, oh, we're short of cash because you're bad at budgeting. That's the bottom line. Today's best email, but you can always send more on this sunny, beautiful Tuesday in the Northwest. Talk at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage too big or small. Collision or paint repairs, Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Gary Astorino writes in, Lars, I see how they arrested six of Stephen Colbert's employees. He's one of the funny liberals on television for breaking into the Capitol. I can't sleep now knowing that I could have been killed. I hope they do a minimum of a year in solitary confinement like last year's groups from January 6th who haven't even been charged yet, signed Gary. Gary, I can't agree with you more. It seems that when Adam Schiff, member of Congress, you know, the guy from California who claimed that he had proof positive that Donald Trump was a Russian mole. Yeah, that guy. He invites Colbert's people to just wander around inside Capitol buildings without legal authorization, without any kind of visitor's pass, and bang on the doors of members of Congress. And when they get caught, is it, oh my God, we've had an insurrection. People were in the Capitol without legal cause. No, no, no. They're friends of liberals. Different rules apply. Coming up, what happens when citizens, fearing they're about to fall victim to a criminal, call 911 for help and get put on hold for many, many minutes? We'll get into that coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So what happens when a citizen, fearing that you're about to fall victim to a criminal or criminals, you call 911 for help, and then you get put on hold for long minutes? Well, I'm joined now by former homicide detective C.W. Jensen. Captain Jensen, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars.
So this is the assumption that people make if you pick up the phone and call 911. The national standard, which is actually set by the National Emergency Number Association, says the standard is 95% of calls to 911 need to be answered within 20 seconds and 90% within 15 seconds. And it sounds as though, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of the cities are falling far short. What should we make of that?
Well, I would say this. Does it have something to do with defunding the police and George Floyd? Yeah, maybe. But this in Portland, I can only speak of Portland, has been a 30-year decline by your city council and mayors. They, you know, have you ever seen Metro put out a public safety ballot measure? No. But the bums, they're throwing money at them. So every time they said, hey, you know, we really ought to improve the 911 center. They go, we really need the money over here, or we need this over here, or we need that. So, and remember, 911 is kind of the linchpin. You know, that's how you get the police, because if we had ESP, we'd just go, hey, I got to go over to Lars's house. Somebody busted in trying to get his catalytic converter or something, but that doesn't happen. So you need those dispatchers, and they're multitasking like most of us could never do.
Well, and when you have a police agency where in a city like Portland, it's about $250 million that gets spent on the police, but none of that does any good if dispatch can't allocate the resources and allocate exactly the right amount. I mean, meaning that if it's a really busy night and you're short of officers and cars and everything else, you allocate to the most life-threatening situations. Other nights, it may be different than that. But like you said, they're the linchpin who make that critical decision. Do I send one car? Do I send two? Do I send three officers? Do I divert people from other sectors and put other neighborhoods at risk? But this scene or this crime, this report needs greater resources or fewer. They're making critical decisions every single minute.
Absolutely. And the thing, when they talk about how long it takes to get your phone call answered, the reason is nobody knows what the phone call is going to be, right?
Yep.
We don't know if the phone call is, hey, somebody's spray painting on the house across from me. It's vandalism. Okay. Or I just got robbed in my home. I'm bleeding and I need 911 EMS. I mean, no one knows what the call is going to be, and that's why it's critical to be staffed in answering those calls. Now, the other problem is when they answer the call and then they dispatch somebody, you don't know how long it's going to take for a cop.
No, and some of that has to do with the staffing. As you said, when they answered the call of the mobs in the streets to defund the cops, you've reduced the number of bodies you've got on the street. And it doesn't take much of a reduction, especially in cities like Seattle and Portland. The West Coast standard for cities of 500,000 and above, that's two cities, if you count Oregon and Washington, is supposed to be, I think it's 2.4 cops per 10,000. So and we're at, I think Seattle's at 1.9 and Portland was at 1.4. So you're already understaffing to begin with. And then it takes even longer to dispatch somebody. The minutes that go by could literally cost somebody his life.
Yeah, I mean, there's sometimes you're on a call, and I mean, I'm talking, you know, the last time I worked the street was as a lieutenant in 92. But, I mean, you need to have the entire system working, and right now the system is breaking down across the board. And it's not George Floyd, it's your city council and your mayor over the last 30 years.
Well, and I'll tell you, CW, I can remember the first time somebody mentioned to me we're short-staffed at the 911 center was in the early 1980s. And I said, well, why are you short-staffed? I said, we lose people, they get burned out, and they especially get burned out when we demand that they take extra overtime shifts because we're short. So the shortage problem feeds on itself. And I said, well, if you need 20 new, but you know you're going to lose 10 in the next 6 months, why don't you hire 40 new dispatchers, get them in the training program. You're going to wash out some of them, but get yourself back up to where you're at least on par where you ought to be for the number of dispatchers. They haven't been able to do that successfully in 40 years. So this isn't just a pandemic problem or a funding problem right now. It sounds like a management problem.
Exactly, and a priority problem. It's priorities. What are the city's priorities? The priorities are bums and addicts.
So what do we do next? I mean, how do we fix this problem? And because to some extent, CW, this is what I resent about government. You pay them up front. They've got your money already. And then you say, now, you're supposed to supply me service. Now, no other relationship where you spend money do you walk into a restaurant and they say, before we even put you at a table, give us $200. And you say, what's that for? That's for the meal you're going to order. And you say, well, hold on, I haven't even seen the menu yet. But we're going to charge you up front. And then whatever you get put on a plate in front of you is what you get. We wouldn't accept that kind of situation from anyone else because there's supposed to be some trust to say, okay, we trust that if we give you all the money to hire 911 operators and police officers and everything else that goes with that, that you will deliver service. And then when they realize, well, if we don't deliver service, what the heck are they going to do? There's nothing you can do.
No, and remember, there's not enough police officers. There are not enough 911 dispatchers. There's probably not enough EMTs. I don't know about the fire department. But across the board, everything is starting to fail, kind of like the Biden administration, frankly, where just there's nothing good. I mean, I read the Oregonian every day just to follow what's going on. And Jesus, between the homicides and the shootings and the fatal car wrecks and 911, I mean, give me some good news. I don't see any.
No, and I don't either. And frankly, especially when it's a management problem. I mean, if the 911, if the head of 911 dispatch for whatever city it happens to be, has to go in front of the council and say, listen, you can't do the job with this number of people. And if you don't give me the funding to bring the number of people on board that we need to bring on board, you're going to end up with people dead. They might actually get some attention, except that in some cases, I wonder if the management, who you almost never hear from, if they've said, you know what, I really like my job. I like my six-figure income as a manager. I like my big pension that I'm going to get someday. And they say, so if I go down to City Hall and complain, they're not going to do anything anyway, and I might just lose my gig. So they say, okay, I'll just paper over all the problems that are going on up here. And if some people have to die so I can keep my job, that's what I'm going to do.
And some people are going to die, guaranteed. People are going to die. And then they'll be falling all over themselves, and they'll declare it a, you know, absolute emergency. But it'll take 18 months to get new dispatchers. And let's face it, if somebody calls a Portland police officer and says, hey, do you recommend I apply for Portland? They go, no, go anywhere else. Being a cop's a great job, but you don't want to be here. And maybe the dispatchers are saying the same thing.
No, they've got to change the equation somehow. And by the way, I have a very good friend I've known for over 40 years who was a dispatcher, and he enjoyed his job, but he didn't work in Portland. And I don't think he would have worked in Portland on a bet because he knew the bad news it was. That's retired police captain C.W. Jensen. C.W., thanks so very much. Coming up, when you ask why Northwest cities don't do more about drug addiction, you usually hear that tired old excuse about not enough money. But what happens when the money is actually there and the folks in charge can't get off the dime? I'll get to that and your phone calls coming up next. You're listening to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day. And it includes the Twitter poll. Today's question, and this is the latest crazy idea to come out of the White House. If the government orders cigarette companies to reduce the nicotine in cigarettes to almost nothing, will it help you quit? I think the answer to that is no. But the Biden White House is considering it. And if you say, well, if they want to reduce it, why don't they reduce it to nothing? Why? Because about 13 years ago, the Congress passed a law saying it's okay to have low nicotine cigarettes. That might actually help some people who intend to quit. They want to do this to all cigarettes. And by the way, when the Congress passed that law in 2009, they also had a hard and fast rule that said you can't reduce it to nothing. So they want to reduce the nicotine to almost nothing. And what do you suppose the average person who has that nicotine fit, you know, they've gone without a cigarette for 2 or 3 hours during a meeting where they couldn't smoke in the meeting, or during an airplane ride or something like that. Do you think if you give them a cigarette with almost no nicotine in it, are they going to smoke one or two or three or five? Is it actually going to change anything? And the government even admits the study they did on it that says this helps people quit. And then they went back and talked to some of the people who took part in the study who admitted, yeah, I was part of the study, but on the sly, I was smoking real cigarettes because I couldn't stand being without the nicotine. Is the nicotine the damaging part of it? Well, I'm going to get into some more of the details in that in a moment. Let me get some calls right now. Let's start with Ron in Tacoma, listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
It sounds a whole lot like what you're talking about, our freedom there. It seems to be watered down just as much as those cigarettes.
Almost to nothing.
I wanted to touch with you on Juneteenth. I got a really good question for you. Maybe you can explain it to me and the public.
All right.
Juneteenth. I'm a little confused. The Democrats are out celebrating it, which is great. I find it fascinating that the Democrat Party is celebrating their loss to the Republicans in a civil war, having their slaves taken away from them. So I'm just curious, are they actually apologizing? Is this their way of apologizing? Because I cannot find any apologies anywhere from the Democrat Party themselves.
No, you're right. And people should know, yesterday was officially the official observance of Juneteenth. And if you say, well, are Democrats in favor of anything that gives, for the most part, government workers another day off with pay? And the answer is no, they're in favor. They love that kind of stuff. That's problem one. Problem two is the one you identified, and that is America had a civil war, and it had to do with states' rights and a number of issues, including slavery. And how did it end? It ended with the preservation of the Union because of Republican President Abraham Lincoln, who then declared the Emancipation Proclamation, and officially Juneteenth is celebrating the news of that, finally getting to the last place in America in Galveston, you know, that it got to the farthest reach away. where they said we've got word that the Emancipation Proclamation is there. That is a tremendous victory, not for the party of slavery. The Democrats have been the party of slavery all along, and I think they want to continue slavery today, just in a different form. So why do they want to celebrate it? In one way, one of the things they're pushing is the idea that this, and they've called it the National Day of Independence. And if you say to yourself, and that's actually what they called the bill that authorized Juneteenth as a federal holiday, the National Day of Independence. Well, Ron, you know what Independence Day is, don't you? What date is it?
Yeah, that would be July 4th.
It would. But if you can replace July 4th, and you say, why would you want to replace it? Because part of the Democrat playbook is to say America was not founded in 1776. It was founded in 1619. And you say, well, no, 1619, we weren't even a country. The argument from the left and from the Democrat Party, the party of slavery, is that America began with the creation of slavery in 1619, and that America has been completely, systemically racist ever since. And they want to suggest that when a Republican president helped keep the Union together, ended the Civil War, declared the Emancipation Proclamation, that somehow that is a victory for people of color. Well, I consider America's Independence Day on July 4th to be the only Independence Day. If we want to celebrate the arrival of the Emancipation Proclamation in Galveston, I have no objection to it, as long as, and this is the caveat, as long as you don't seek to displace America's true Independence Day. That's my bottom line. And do you expect the Democrats to be consistent? No, not at all. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network and our flagship KXL. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, just was listening to the homicide detective you brought on. I actually, in 2016, almost took a job with Portland Police Department. The starting wages, I believe, were about $56,000. And looking at the, you know, political climate and everything, I just made the decision it wasn't worth it. And I know a lot of people in the same scenario. You know, it was easier to keep our jobs making more money and not dealing with the, you know, pushback from society for having to do a job that we need. You know, and now I'd say, you know, I think the starting wage for Portland Police is about $76,000. So they have raised it. But, you know, who's wanting to come here? Why would you come and want to work here? Why would you, you know, put yourself at risk to lose your career potentially forever because you do one thing and the whole public freaks out? And then the people that are taking these jobs, how many of them are just trying to get that 1 year of experience and then laterally transfer out of Portland? So I'd say we do have openings, but who wants to work, you know, overtime making not that great of money to deal with what you deal with? And, you know, personally, I wouldn't take it right now if they were paying me $140,000 a year to start.
I don't blame you at all. Mike, thanks very much. It's the Radio Northwest Network. It's a Tuesday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And in the interest of full disclosure, I smoke cigars from time to time. I have never smoked cigarettes as a regular habit. So you know my bias in this case, but it's not anti-cigarette. I think it's your choice what you want to smoke. And obviously, we live in a day and age when more and more states are legalizing things like pot for recreational purposes. At least with cigarettes, you don't become intoxicated by smoking cigarettes. But the White House has a brand new assault that it's about to launch on people who smoke cigarettes in this country. And in fact, that assault falls most heavily on those people who are among the lowest income classes in America. Now, it's not meant to be an insult to anybody to say that demographically, people who are poor smoke cigarettes more than people who are affluent or even rich. But having said that, here's the way they're rolling it out. The White House is expected to announce as soon as today, Tuesday, that it intends to issue a rule requiring tobacco companies to lower the nicotine in cigarettes to minimal or non-addictive levels. According to a person familiar with the situation, we actually brought this up about a week ago because we could hear the news on the way. And then they point out almost 500,000 people die every year of what they call smoking-related causes, and tobacco use remains the leading cause of preventable death. Okay, it's also a choice. And in America, choice, other than abortion, seems to be going away really fast. Choice in First Amendment rights, choice in Second Amendment rights, choice in just about everything where the government is capable of regulating you. But here's what really doesn't make sense to me. I'm going to tell you what doesn't make sense to me. But first, I want to invite you to the conversation. We endeavor to make this the best conversation in talk journalism. And we invite you to take part. You can call in 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that two places, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. And if you don't like Twitter like me, go to my website, cast the vote there. It counts the same. But glad to have you with me. Here's the problem I see with this. Having explained that I don't really have a bias in favor of cigarettes or against cigarettes, I do have a bias in favor of letting Americans make their own choices. And it was pointed out, speaking of choices, the very people who are enforcing the vaccine mandate at Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services are themselves exempt from the very mandate that they seek to enforce. So, like a lot of other things, the government loves to tell citizens what to do, but then they turn around and declare themselves exempt from those rules. I don't think there's a way they can do that with cigarettes, but having said that, here's the thinking they have, because it might have occurred to you that nicotine is the addictive chemical that people get addicted to when they get addicted to smoking. And I've had people who are in the treatment business tell me that nicotine addiction can be as tough to break as heroin addiction. Now, different, of course, in other ways. Nicotine does not cause cancer. Nicotine does not cause lung disease, according to who? The FDA. Those diseases are caused by all the other garbage that comes in the smoke that you inhale to get the nicotine. So what does the White House plan to do? To tell people we're going to take the nicotine down to almost nothing. They have a law they have to follow that was passed by Congress about 13 years ago that says they can't tell the cigarette companies you have to reduce it to zero. They're actually prohibited from doing that, but they want to take it down to almost nothing. Now, if it occurs to you, well, if somebody who's used to getting a certain amount of nicotine by smoking one cigarette finds out that one cigarette does not satisfy that craving, what are they going to do? Well, you don't have to have a medical degree to say they're probably going to smoke two cigarettes or maybe three cigarettes. And if you ask yourself, well, isn't that likely to cause them to smoke more, to inhale more smoke, and to get more of the very things that are doing the damage that causes the cancer or is associated with other kinds of lung problems? Well, about 15 years ago, the Wall Street Journal reports this, 15 years ago, a bunch of scientists and government officials and tobacco control veterans, so they were all in favor of controlling tobacco in some way, even though state governments and the federal government have made hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars over the decades on the sale of tobacco. So the very folks who work for agencies that make money on selling cigarettes, I would venture to say that in almost every case, the government makes more money on the sale of cigarettes than the cigarette companies make on the sale of cigarettes. That also tends to be true in gasoline, where the government makes more money on the sale of gasoline than the folks who actually produce the product, the evil oil companies. Well, that research, funded by the federal government, done by about a dozen universities, was shown that when people use cigarettes with very low nicotine levels, they smoke fewer cigarettes and they become less dependent, and eventually they may be able to quit. If people want to quit, they can quit right now, but that should be their choice. One of the problems is that when they did this study and then went back later and talked to some of the people, the test subjects, the lab rats, if you will, they found that a lot of them cheated. They admitted that they cheated. They said, oh, yeah, I was in that study. They told me to smoke the low nicotine cigarette, and then I just went out and smoked some real cigarettes. So they're going to do this to try to get people off of cigarettes, which I don't think is part of the job of government. Is government supposed to look out for national security? Yes. Is it doing a good job at that? No. Is the government supposed to look out for public safety at the local level, state, you know, police and courts and cops? Yes. Are they doing a good job? No. But they claim that reducing the amount of nicotine in cigarettes will actually make people quit cigarettes faster instead of simply smoking more. I don't think it makes sense. The researchers found that if the nicotine strength was reduced moderately, smokers would inhale more deeply. But they went on to research and said, well, if you can cut it by 95%, you'll get people to smoke less eventually, and this is what the White House wants to jam down your throats right now, almost literally. On that note, let's go to Greg. Hey, Greg, you had a comment on this. What's on your mind?
Well, I think you ought to challenge the government and say, hey, well, why don't we just get rid of alcohol? More people die from alcoholic-related deaths from, you know, auto accidents and liver disease than cigarettes. That's for damn sure. So let's just get rid of alcohol, too. Why not?
I think we've been there and done that, haven't we?
Yeah, but I'm being facetious, okay?
I know you are. I know you are.
I mean, I'm just saying it's another asinine thing for the government to get involved and be a social engineer in our lives rather than doing the things you had mentioned, like keeping us safe and securing the border and funding the police and making our communities safe.
I couldn't agree with you more. Greg, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. And by the way, have you noticed that the government seemed to be falling all over themselves to legalize pot with no filters, no safety standards, no none of that? I figure cigarettes will be the lawsuits and the government action of today, and pot smoking will probably be the government action that's coming at us decades down the path. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. Let me mention this first. Number one, I want to mention the Twitter poll today. You can find it online at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. If the government orders cigarette companies to reduce nicotine to almost nothing, will that help you quit? I don't smoke cigarettes, but I don't think it's going to help anybody quit. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, about the other matter I want to mention to you, Juneteenth. Now, I've talked to people about Juneteenth. Frankly, celebrating the accomplishment of the Emancipation Proclamation from the Republican president who ended the Civil War, kept the Union together, and then gave the Emancipation Proclamation. Celebrating the day it arrived in Galveston, Texas, there's nothing wrong with that. But you see, the Democrats have another agenda, and let me give you an idea of what it is. Number one, they want to suggest that Juneteenth is actually America's Independence Day. But that's based on the idea that America was an irredeemably evil and systemically racist country formed not in 1776, but founded in 1619, long before we became a country, with the creation of slavery, the arrival of the first slaves in North America, which wouldn't become a country for another 150 years or so. And now the second agenda, members of Congress and others pointing to the Juneteenth holiday are pushing for expansion of the 13th Amendment. Now, the 13th Amendment dealt directly with slavery. The problem is they say that they now want to extend the 13th Amendment by amending it again, amending the amendment, and suggest that people who are arrested and tried and convicted of committing crimes are, in effect, slaves. Nkema Williams, who's a member of Congress from Georgia, says, I'm bold enough to think that I can change the Constitution, and I know there's a national, bipartisan, multiracial movement to get it done. Now, why she cares so much about race, I don't know. The Constitution's 13th Amendment abolishing slavery was ratified in 1865 following the Civil War. Juneteenth recognized the news when it got to Texas 2 years later and is celebrated on the third Saturday in June, and of course a federal holiday for government workers. But they say they want to extend it, the protection, to people who are held in prison. And as my friend, the former district attorney, points out, yeah, the problem with that little theory is that people were made slaves not by their own choice at all, but people are made criminals by their choice to go out and do things that are against laws. And one of the key things you have to take into account in America, if you cannot understand the criminal nature of what you have done, the courts will not allow you to be convicted of that crime. Now, that doesn't happen all that often when somebody is crazy enough to not understand that murdering people is against the law. But you can only be convicted and imprisoned if you understand the criminal nature of what you did, and you did it anyway. That's a voluntary action. Very different from slavery, but there are a lot of other agendas. And while I agree with the overall thought of Juneteenth, celebrated by all the government workers who got the day off yesterday, I don't agree with the notion that we should amend the 13th Amendment and put slaves on par with convicted criminals. That one makes no sense at all. Let's go first to Bill. Hey, Bill, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, I just wanted to pick your brain on the cigarette one. Who is the big drug companies that put out the cancer cures, and what's the possibility of them lobbying for this to have people smoke more of the actual chemicals that cause the cancer, just to sell more cures?
Well, I mean, while there have been some big developments recently in curing cancer, I think that's going to be a tough haul because there are a couple of cancers like breast cancer that are addressed by pharmaceuticals. But for the most part, if you get lung cancer, there's no magic cure for it that the pharma companies can sell. So I'm not sure they're pushing this. I think this is being pushed by a whole different group of people who don't like cigarettes, and they don't like other people smoking cigarettes, which, again, same crowd of people that says our bodies, our choice, and that a woman can kill an unborn baby who's done nothing wrong at all are the same folks who say, but it shouldn't be your choice to smoke tobacco, even though the risks of doing it are very well known. But interesting theory. Let's go to Rob. Hey, Rob, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Lars, thanks for taking my call. I've been listening for 2 years, but I try to listen to you every afternoon. Just a couple quick comments. I just wanted to mention I'm a Latin American, and I'm very proud of being American. But I'm also a little bit extra proud this week because Myra Flores won. And the way she talks, I really hope everybody's listening, whether you're Hispanic, Mexican, white, black. I like what she has in mind to do on the border, and I hope she follows through, and I hope everybody jumps on board. I'm very proud of her and proud of that win. And one more thing I have to add, just to clear the air on the details of Biden on the bike, he was not riding the bike. The bike was standing. He was standing still, and he also tried to blame the bicycle if he's seen that little clip on the beach. He has.
And the fact that the president can't ride a bicycle, I think they put him on that bike, Rob, to show how fit and active and capable he is. And then they got exactly the opposite result. You're right. He was very nearly stopped when he fell over off his bicycle. And we all know that he falls going up the stairs into Air Force One. But about Myra Flores, who I find a much more compelling topic than Joe Biden any day of the week, I haven't had a chance to interview her yet, but she's a smart politician. And she's done something amazing. And I want to point something out, since you're Latino or Hispanic, I want to point something out. Ordinarily, the mainstream media loves to talk about the first this and the first that, first gay person to be on a certain court, or first a person of color who to occupy this job or that job. In her case, they're ignoring the fact she is the first woman born in Mexico to become a member of the United States Congress. Now, if you're into all those firsts, I tend not to look at people's skin color, nation of origin, or what church they go to or don't go to. But have you noticed the deafening silence about that? Because if she'd been a Democrat and she was the first Mexican-born woman to be in the United States Congress, the mainstream media would just be loving her all day long and twice on Sunday. But because she's a Republican, they're essentially ignoring it. And the fact that she took on a district that has been, I think it's actually been held by Democrat members of Congress since the 1800s, if memory serves. And she's done something amazing politically and amazing for a Mexican-born, now American woman. And it should make you mad that the media, if they set a standard saying we should take note of these firsts, then why aren't you taking note of Myra Flores?
You bring up a very good point compared to the attention that Ketanji Brown and Kamala Harris had. You bring up a really good point. And I also love that Myra called the VP useless. That's one good word that sums it all up with Harris.
And I think you're absolutely right. Rob, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Mike Gonzalez is our friend, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, author most recently of his book, BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. Mike, good to have you back.
Lars, it's always a pleasure to be on with you.
Now, I know that there are times in politics when there's an attempt to rehabilitate somebody's image, you know, and it's, sometimes that works out very well, and sometimes it doesn't work out all that well at all. But are the communists here in the United States trying to sort of shine up the image of Nicolas Maduro by showing that he's perhaps woke to try to make him look a little more friendly as Joe Biden begs him for some more oil from Venezuela?
Yeah, that's what I think is happening, exactly that, the Democratic Socialists of America. First of all, American socialists, our growing numbers of American Marxists have always been very kind towards Maduro. You know, Oliver Stone and Michael Moore and Sean Penn have always gone to Caracas to praise the great Bolivarian revolution, which obviously is nothing of the sort. It's just turned a good economy into a basket case, and has cost millions to immigrate. But what is new is this turn by Maduro to appear woke, to after years of homophobic statements, they're now pressing for LGBTQ issues. They're painting the bike paths in Caracas the colors of the rainbow flag. They have a tour of Venezuelan women here in America, saying that our sanctions against Maduro are hitting women the worst of all. And that coincides with a visit last July to Caracas by a delegation of the Democratic Socialists of America, who Code Pink is very involved in this as well. And you know, it doesn't take a genius to put two and two together, especially when you see how involved the Democratic Socialists of America are in social media promoting all of these things I have just described. Maduro's new woke image is being very much promoted by the DSA. So there's two things here. One, American Marxists have always supported the Marxists in Caracas because they're both Marxists. But the new one is that it's clear the Democratic Socialists of America are saying, look, you got to say the right things to attract the Kamala Harris crowd.
Well, their argument is that a country that could be very wealthy because of its oil rich in nature.
But they don't pump.
Go ahead.
No, I said a country that was, in fact, very wealthy.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying they were wealthy. But like most socialist regimes, they ran the oil industry into the ground. I mean, they took control of it, and then instead of actually reinvesting some of what they made in it, they just let it decline in production, because as long as the elites were getting enough money, enough fuel, enough money, and enough everything else, they could let the whole thing decline and just put all the money into their own, you know, causes and the elites who make a lot of money. And if the common person suffered, but then it's our problem because we put sanctions on an evil regime like Maduro, not his problem because he's effectively ignoring most of the country's oil wealth and not pumping it out and selling it to the benefit of the Venezuelan people.
Right. And that is just a continuation of the Blame America First strategy, which our left thinks that we're really powerful. In fact, the left thinks that we're powerful than the right things. We're so powerful that our sanctions cause all of this mayhem in the world. No, it doesn't. It doesn't really have to be a top shelf analyst to understand that socialism has produced poverty everywhere. It produces bread lines. It doesn't produce bread. So that's what has happened to Venezuela. It doesn't nothing to do with our sanctions. Our sanctions are hurting Maduro and his relatives. And our government, the Biden administration, very misguidedly, has lifted sanctions on Maduro's family, which should be in place because these are people who are, this is a narco-terrorist regime. So this approach has not led anywhere good. But I think what the Democratic Socialists of America want to do is attract, make the Maduro government even more attractive to the Harris-Biden people.
Well, and Mike, I'm talking to Mike Gonzalez, who's at Heritage, but his new book is called BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. So on one hand, you've got Joe Biden saying, I'm going to sanction not just Putin and oligarchs, but I'm even going to sanction Putin's daughters, you know, who I don't think there's any argument that says that somehow sanctioning his daughters is going to bring about a change in policy about Ukraine. So it's okay to do that, to aim at two young ladies, that you're going to sanction them and hurt them. But it's not okay to sanction, Maduro's family. So I tell my audience that if the Democrats didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all. But that one really doesn't make sense because it's happening all, you know, right in front of us. You say, okay, sanction Putin's daughters, don't sanction Maduro's family. How does that make sense?
See, it doesn't. I'm a lot more consistent than that. I am for sanctioning Maduro's family, and I am for sanctioning Putin's family. I think that this approach is not bad necessarily, but lifting sanctions on Maduro's family at this juncture is just plain old stupid.
Yeah, it is. So what happens at this point? Are they going to be able to shine up his image enough to make it okay for Joe to go hat in hand to Maduro and say, hey, please pump more oil? Not because we actually want more oil, because we're actually greenies. We hate oil, and we're trying to kill America's oil industry. But we'd like the Venezuelan oil industry to do well enough to get us past the November elections, because $5, $6 gas is not doing us any favors.
Well, all of that, I think, is the complete truth. If you put together all the elements you just brought up, I think that's the truth. I don't think Biden himself is green. I think Biden doesn't really know what he is at this point, but I think Biden understands or is being told, look, you must do this, whether it's by Susan Rice or by Klain or by anyone, by other people in the White House. He is being told there's no way you can allow Americans to drill for oil. We need more supply of oil because if the price is through the roof, you're going to pay a political price for this. So the supply has to come from somewhere. So let's make it come from Venezuela. Obviously, this is the height of hypocrisy, but this is what politics, what he thinks is political expedient at the moment.
Well, Mike, one last issue, and that is, has Joe Biden shifted his comments a little bit to say, hey, these high prices, not all that bad. They're actually going to help us make a transition, because it seems that they've started to change a little bit of that language. A year ago, he was saying, oh, don't worry, the oil prices are only high for a little while. It's transitory. And now he's apparently saying, well, I guess they're okay because they help us push Americans where we want them to go. Is the whole administration going to try and tell people high oil and gas prices are a good thing? Like, you know, the old joke about telling somebody it's raining when they're actually doing something on their leg?
You know, so far I've only seen Biden do it. And I must say that I'm baffled. I'm completely baffled that he's taking this approach. The high price of gas is hurting a lot of people. I would argue that Biden's policies have inflicted a great deal of pain across the board on all Americans. But the price, this is something you feel once or twice a week, and it really is a shock. And for him to go out and say, this is a transition, this is going to help us transition to a Greek future, to a green future, this really, I've only seen him do it. I haven't seen other people do it. Maybe those around him think, there's no way he's running in 2024. Nobody can stand him anymore. Even people who voted for him can't stand the sight of him. Might as well have him say this, since he's already damaged goods, and see how the message plays out.
He can pass. He can take the damage because he's already damaged goods. That's Mike Gonzalez from Heritage. BLM, The Making of a New Marxist Revolution. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. I want to mention this. The city of Seattle, like a lot of the big governments in the Pacific Northwest, has been spending like crazy. Now, 2 years ago, they were really on a spending spree because in 2020, they got a massive amount of federal money, all borrowed, all that's going to have to be paid off by somebody's grandkids someday because that came from the federal government. They also had a brand new tax called Jumpstart that pumped in a couple of $100 million. And now this year, they're saying, but by next year, we're going to be $117 million short. Now, I might point out that Seattle has tripled its spending on the so-called homeless. So maybe the question is, how long is it going to take before the citizens of a city or a county like Multnomah County and Portland, like King County and Seattle, how long are they going to tolerate massive spending on the homeless? And then a city that turns around and says, I'm sorry, for the services the rest of you expect, we're just short of money. We won't be able to produce those things, or you can pay a huge amount in taxes. Let's go to Anthony in Port Orchard, Washington. Hey, Anthony, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, appreciate you as always. Hey, I had a quick question regarding the cigarette thing, and like you, currently, I'm not biased. I guess the biggest difference is I have smoked at one point in time in my life or not, but I don't currently and haven't for a while. But my main question is, are the supplements like gum and patches and such, are those attached to pharma? Are those attached to pharmaceutical companies? Or are those, how are those run?
They may be attached. They may be attached in that I think some of them are by prescription and some of them are just made by companies that, I mean, at this point, I don't know that there is in fact, I know there are companies that make things like snus and chew, and they make gum, and they make all kinds of products that if you want to supplement your nicotine so that you can break the smoking habit, if that's what you desire, some of those are made, a lot of them are made by just private companies that sell nicotine products. Some are probably made as, gotcha. So there's a mix. Some are probably made as a prescription drug, but most of it is just you go in and you want to buy it, you buy it. So there's some financial tie that's there. Right. But Anthony, does it make sense what the White House is apparently going to propose, that we're going to sell people cigarettes that the government still makes a massive amount of money on? Most of the cost of a pack of cigarettes, which I think is around 10 bucks, goes to the government, not to the cigarette company, and then tell the cigarette companies, take the very thing that people smoke these cigarettes for, the nicotine, and take it out, or take most of it out, and leave in just the smoke, which contains tar and all kinds of other things that actually cause the problem. Leave that in. Does that one make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely not, man. I mean, we live amongst double standard that you can cut with a knife. It's so thick anymore. But my point with that is, I mean, we, and I use that term very loosely because it's not my party typically that associates with it, but I mean, we sympathize with people that have self-inflicted addictions and issues from that, and it seems that the rawest source, like a pack of cigarettes, would be like I don't know. To me, it just seems like we're encouraging more dependency on people telling us essentially how to dress and how to act, and it's just really
that's right. And we ought to ought to reject it because this nanny statism. I mean, if they can decide you shouldn't smoke cigarettes, Anthony, do you suppose they might also say, by the way, Lars, you're carrying too many pounds. You should lose some of those. We're going to tell you how to eat. And we're going to tell you that you have to buy health insurance. That was Obamacare. And then we're going to tell you what you have to do. We're going to tell you what pronoun you're allowed to say to describe yourself. And we're going to tell you what pronoun you're allowed to say to describe people around you. We're going to let the nanny, we're going to let the government act like mommy and daddy, and we're all 6 years old and need to be told every single thing that we do.
And where and when does it end? I mean, it's just
for the Democrats, it never does. I don't think for the Democrats it ever does. Whereas most look, my attitude is maybe a little more libertarian, Anthony, but if somebody tells me they smoke, I'm not going to tell them not to. Now, if they ask me, what do you think of smoking? I say, well, you know, it's associated with some health problems. but only if they ask my opinion am I going to tell them what I think. I mean, I tell people all the time that if I came to your house, Anthony, and spent a week, not that you'd want that to happen, but if I came there, if I was that kind of busybody, I should say, Anthony, you should have more green on your plate at dinner, and you should eat more of this and less of that, and you should go out and read a book to your kid every single night. I mean, it would all sound like legitimate advice, but did you ask me to come and run your life or even contribute an opinion? Anthony, you read too many of these kind of books and not enough of those. Anthony, you watch too much TV. You spend too little time with your kids. Anthony, you should get out and clean up the flower beds. Your house looks messy. Anthony, you know, do you want me to be your worst nightmare of a mother-in-law or father-in-law?
Oh, no. But, Lars, once upon a time, we had to start putting warning labels on peanuts that say, you know, this package contains nuts. So, I mean, We live in weird times, man. But
yeah, it's strange times.
But
who could imagine being the kind of busybody that's constantly telling other people? Now, what I do, I tell people what my opinion is. If they ask me, what's your opinion of this? I'll say, it's a good idea or it's a bad idea. But I don't think it's my job. I don't think it's my place to tell other people how to live their lives. If you said, should you read the book more? Yeah, everybody should read the book more, the Bible. But is it my job to tell you that? Well, I'll make the suggestion, but nothing more than that. You got the Lars Larson Show. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I will admit to you that some days I feel like I'm shouting into the wind because I say, hold on, we're going to have blackouts and brownouts ahead. We're going to be short of electricity. And when even people like Climate Jay Inslee, Governor of Washington, say we're going to have power shortages and they're going to come this year and next year, and then I turn around and see people advocating for tearing out some of the greenest, cleanest power we've got, the Lower Snake River dams, and on top of that, all the other benefits that come from those dams. I know I've got to talk to Pam Lewison, who is director of the Washington Policy Center Initiative on Agriculture. Pam, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I like to tell people that you got to count the benefits of those dams as transportation, power generation, recreation, flood control, and irrigation. And irrigation's a big deal for agriculture here in the Northwest. If folks like Jay Inslee want to tear out these dams, what the heck is that going to do to the people who you represent?
You know, I think it has a huge impact on food production, and I think what that report from Governor Inslee and Patty Murray highlight is the lack of care invested in the agriculture portion of the research done in that report.
What does the report, these reports, because what you're talking about is, I think it was $700,000 that Inslee and Murray, Senator Murray, put together to have a study done saying, okay, what's this going to cost? And they just put in dollar terms and say, okay, we tear out the dams, that may or may not help the fish. They may or may not need the help because the fish numbers are actually up in recent years, which belies all their complaints about the dams. But then they just say, well, we'll just have to pony up with two or three tens of billions of dollars to replace the power and the water and everything else. If they take the dams out, you might be able to replace the power with something else. I'm not quite sure what, but can they replace the water that the farmers need to be able to irrigate the fields and produce the agriculture that the Northwest does so well?
Interestingly, they estimate the total replacement cost for just the ag portion to be about $1 billion. I think that number is significantly low, particularly when you look at things like the crop value. Just in Benton, Franklin, and Walla Walla counties, which are the three counties really close to the Snake River, they produce about $2 billion worth of revenue in food products alone. And most of those come from irrigated acres, about 500,000 irrigated acres, in fact. So when you take out the dams and they're estimating $1 billion in replacement costs, and then you look at the food produced at being $2 billion in food production, I question the research methodology in particular, and I question it even more when this is a report that has no data sources cited in it for where they're getting the numbers about how much food is produced and where the irrigation comes from.
Well, and that's the other piece of this, Pam. I mean, there are folks down in the Klamath Basin, which was promised 100 years ago, if you'll come here and farm it, the government will make sure you have water. And then the water gets cut off. You could give a Klamath Falls farmer a pile of money as big as his barn, and I don't know where he'd get the water. There, the water isn't for sale. So if you go to these farmers and say, we're going to take away the irrigation water you now get from having those dams there, but you can replace it. Here's a pile of money. Where do they come up with the water?
I think what this particular report says is we're going to take away the dams, but what you can do instead is drill a well. If you look at things happening in Washington State in particular, wells and aquifer problems are already running rampant in that area of the state. Yep. And we have a State Department of Ecology saying, no, you can't drill more wells. And in fact, if you do, and those wells interfere with municipal and domestic water sources, we'll come to your farm and tell you that we're going to cap your well forever, and you do not get to farm with water ever again. So it puts irrigated farming in a really precarious position where, on the one hand, they're being told in this study, you can just dig your wells deeper. And we have a State Department of Ecology telling those same folks, if you dig your wells any deeper and it starts to interfere with other people's ability to function, you don't get to irrigate at all.
Well, and isn't it relatively inevitable that in a dry part of the country, that if you dig wells and you start putting more wells in to replace all the water they're currently getting because of the lower Snake River dams, you're going to affect the water? It's not a question of if, it's a question of how much and how soon, isn't it?
It really is. And a lot of those wells were meant to be temporary. They were supposed to be just temporary permits meant to get people by until irrigation was available, either through the Columbia Basin Project, if you happen to be a Columbia River irrigator, or if you're irrigating out of the Snake River, you're supposed to have access to that water effectively forever on your water permit.
So the end result is you'll wipe out agriculture. That'll wipe out a lot of the businesses that support agriculture, and that will wipe out whole communities. But it's in a rural part of the state, so why should Jay care?
Well, and I think that's part of the problem, too, is, you know, we've seen for the last how many legislative sessions that agriculture and our governor seem to have a very combative relationship, despite what the governor might say. And so it puts agriculture in a position where they're just not sure what to do or where they stand, other than to say, we need the reservoirs that are behind the Snake River dams, and we need permits for water out of the river.
Now, I got to tell you, Pam, I live in the Vancouver, Washington area. Just a week ago, we were at flood stage on all the major rivers, and you could see it. My wife and I, because we used to live on a boat on the river, looked at that and said, wow, the river's really running high today. Where would we be for flood control if we eliminate those dams? They said, well, you still have Bonneville Dam, or you have all these other Columbia River dams, but the Columbia River dams without the backup of the Snake River dams can't do as much good. Aren't we putting our big communities in danger of flooding as well?
Absolutely. All of the dams along the Columbia and Snake Rivers work in concert with each other to help with flood control. And it's certainly a system that is interconnected with one another.
Yeah, and if you take a few of them out and say, well, we'll just count on the big dams on the Columbia to control it all, that isn't going to work. Pam, thanks very much. And that's Pam Lewison, who's director of the Washington Policy Center Initiative on Agriculture. And I would suggest, too, an awful lot of the media on the west side of Oregon and Washington doesn't seem to pay very much attention to the kind of policies and the way they're going to hit people on the east side of the Cascade Mountains. Back in just a moment, I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS, and we'll talk about whether or not we need a more woke world and whether making a woke world is part of the job of the U.S. Navy. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Lightyear bombed in a major way. Disney seems to be going gay. They'll replace Mickey Mouse or give him a male spouse. It's a woke world after all. When you work at Disney, you have no say. When they lie that DeSantis is anti-gay, he's protecting your child, but the liberals go wild. It's a woke world after all. The woke agenda at Disney rules. The board of directors are liberal tools. Want to indoctrinate, they won't allow debate. It's a woke world after all. Disney will pay for being so woke. If they don't back down soon, they'll be broke. Nobody will show, and they'll lose lots of dough. It's the real world after all. I know you are, but what am I?
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That's our great parody guy, the great Jim Gossett. I want to talk about wokeness right now, but welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails directly to me, talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. Now, it's one thing for the Disney Corporation to drive itself toward bankruptcy with wokeness and all the nonsense they've done. That's a private institution. But if you thought the job of the United States military was to win wars and protect the security of the United States, you're right. That'd be my definition. But it seems the Joe Biden administration thinks the military is some kind of social experiment that's aimed at making the world more woke. Case in point. And this, we've confirmed, the Navy confirms, this is part of their messaging that they're putting out through an outfit, a part of the government called the Defense Visual Information Distribution Service, that is part of the official U.S. Navy training. They are training servicemen and women to do what's called cultivating safe spaces through the use of pronouns. The video in particular, this one, that we have confirmed did come from the U.S. Navy. It's not a joke. It's not a parody like Jim Gossett's songs. It features two service members from the Naval Undersea Warfare Center. They're engineers, Johnny Rosen and Conchi Vasquez, discussing inclusive language like using "Hey, everyone" instead of "Hey, guys." Take a listen to the part of this PSA. Take a listen to it right here.
Hi, my name is Johnny, and I use he, him pronouns.
Hi, and I'm Conchi, and I use she, her pronouns.
And we're here to talk about pronouns.
What is a pronoun? A pronoun is how we identify ourselves apart from our name, and it's also how people refer to us in conversations.
Using the right pronouns is a really simple way to affirm someone's identity. It is a signal of acceptance and respect.
It may be
a signal of acceptance and respect.
I don't see it as a signal of a military that's preparing for the job it actually does. Using the right pronouns, both of these two, you can't see the video, but I have LGBTQIA plus pride flags on their clothing, and they distributed this. They then modeled it after a children's show. The video was obtained by the Washington Free Beacon. Listen to what they say about misgendering and how that is a danger for people in uniform.
But what would I do if I misgender someone?
I think the first thing to recognize is that it's not the end of the world. You correct yourself and move on, or you accept the correction and move on. The most important thing I can tell you is do not put the burden of making you feel good about your mistake on the person that you just misgendered.
Oh, thank you for telling me that.
Oh, thank you for telling us that. Yeah, because you have to worry about whether or not you're using the right gender and the right pronoun when you're talking about winning wars and protecting the United States of America. If I get a naysayer call, I would love to hear somebody who thinks this is a proper part of United States military training. Now to your calls. Let's start out with Greg, who has a concern about Pete Buttigieg, the Transportation Secretary of the United States. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program. I think you may have seen the same reports I did about Buttigieg having been booted off one of his flights, and now he's decided that he may punish the airlines.
And the fix for that, according to him, is more customer service aides. We need more pilots. A lot of pilots retired during the pandemic. We need pilots and planes. Somehow, in today's America, getting the job done is secondary to how you feel. So how does that get fixed? You want to go from Dallas to Austin. Well, I guess that's bad. Dallas to Philadelphia. You have to fly, and you have to move people. But that's all secondary now. It's about trying to make people feel good about their situation, even though that you can't provide the service. It's ridiculous. And anybody who is for green energy, it's against hydroelectric, is a moron.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, Greg, the thing about Buttigieg, the fact that he starts paying attention to a problem because he had a problem, because he got booted off a flight, is really telling you something, because we've been hearing about airline cancellations now for months. And the fact that this guy, who wasn't even a good small-town mayor in South Bend, Indiana, couldn't keep the roads paved, couldn't keep peace with his local police department, and that his understanding is, well, if we just get enough people behind the counter at the ticket counter at the airport, that'll make more airplanes take off and land. You're right. It's a ridiculous suggestion. And frankly, let me throw one more element into it, Greg. There are an awful lot of airline pilots who've now been sidelined because they took the jab, they took the vaccination, and then they ended up with major health problems that appear to be associated with the jab, and they're now sidelined and can't ever be pilots again. And then there were the pilots who said, I'm not going to take the jab, and they were pushed into retirement. And so we could fix a lot of this problem if the airline simply said, look, we're not going to be covered by these rules anymore. We'll let everybody decide if they want to take the vaccination or not. And you've got another issue, and that is if you've taken the jab, and I don't know if you've heard the story of the pilot who was flying, I think it was Dallas-Fort Worth to Denver, Colorado. He pulls up to the gate, and about 6 minutes after the plane pulls in, he has a heart attack. Now, he's okay, but he's now sidelined permanently as a pilot. And he believes it was associated with the jab that he was forced to take because they basically laid down an edict to him and said, you either take the jab or we fire you. Well, he took the jab, had health problems, and now he's getting fired anyway. We could solve this problem if the government would simply get out of the business of telling people they have to take the jab. Would you agree?
Yes, and America used to be about excellence. There were problems in 50 years ago, but you wanted to excel, whether you were digging a ditch or doing a cranial biopsy. You wanted to excel, do the best you can. That is gone from America, and it's gone from the workforce. It shows in everything that this country tries to provide. It just excellence is gone.
I think you're right. By the way, speaking of cranial biopsies, what do you suppose they'd find if they actually did one of those on Joe Biden right now?
It'd be like the old CAT scan where they'd have a cat with a magnifying glass looking for something over the patient.
Greg, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Glad to be with you and always glad to take your calls. As you know, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And now the White House is talking about a gas tax holiday from the federal gas tax. Is it too little, too late? We'll get to that next on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment. I will tell you that a federal gas tax holiday, the federal gas tax is 18.3 cents. In most states, even the low tax states, the state gas tax is twice that much. In some cases, it's much more than that. A federal gas tax holiday is not going to make a gigantic difference, but at this point, every little bit helps. So I'm a bit ambivalent about this. So when I'm ambivalent like that on something involving numbers and money, I turn to Véronique Desrougies, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center and knows more about economics than I could ever hope to know. Véronique, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Lars.
Does the White House is apparently considering a federal gas tax holiday, 18.3 cents, even if the holiday was a year or two or five or whatever it happened to be, it wouldn't make a gigantic difference to the federal budget, probably wouldn't make a gigantic difference to the average American who, if they buy $10 worth or 10 gallons of gas, which is now a lot of money, can be $60, $70, $80, they'll save $1.80 without the federal gas tax. Does it make any sense to have a holiday since the government, to a large extent, caused this problem, the inflation and the gas and the oil prices and the gas prices? Should they also take a cut, or does it, will it make any difference at all?
No, they shouldn't actually be doing this, because the problem when you have inflation, especially inflation that's created by overinflated demand, what you need is you need demand to go down. And in a way, what inflation does by raising prices, it does have an effect on demand. And the problem is, if you try to artificially lower the price, even as little as that, right, what you're doing is like you're not letting the demand go down as much as it needs. And it means inflation is going to drag on and continue longer. I understand the instinct. I understand thinking, well, you know, they created this, so why not? I mean, after all, I mean, do I have to be paying the price? But the problem is, like, by not tackling inflation right now, we're only for more pain, in for more pain going forward.
Let me ask you this, though, Véronique, because I haven't been able to find any numbers that describe this, but ordinarily, you know, when prices of something go up, demand goes down. If steak doubles in price, then you buy less steak. Maybe you buy more hamburger, you buy something else. Except with gasoline and diesel, there isn't really a substitute good that you can put in place of the gas and diesel, where you go from steak to hamburger. There's no gasoline to what? To nothing. But has demand actually shown any response at all to the gigantic increase in prices over just the last year?
So I haven't looked at numbers, but they are actually evidence that this is a good that you can live without to some extent. They are, at the margin, changes that you can make to your consumption of gas that is going to reduce your demand and then your cost in gasoline. So, for instance, you can decide that you're not going to be the one driving around all the neighborhood kids, and you're going to, you know, or you're going to walk more, or you're going, like, people, for instance, people who live in the city and usually take their car to go to work, they may take the subway. I mean, there are things that you can do, or you may not go on that weekend to visit your parents. Let's say if you live in Virginia, in Pennsylvania, because you just don't want to have to pay for that gas bill. So there are things that you can do. Now, there are people who have, like, no choice, right, where they need their car to go to work. And for them, really, I mean, they just don't have a lot of leg room. But for other people, there's more option. It's the same, like, with the price of energy. Okay, in France, energy prices have always been really high, right? And people don't leave their lights on. They have systems like to only go, you know, to only use the washer, you know, so many times. They wash stuff by hand. I mean, there's just a lot of people can do. There's always a lot of things you can do at the margin.
Well, but there again, are things you can do
for everyone.
But Véronique, if somebody's used to driving, I don't know, 300 miles a week, you know, because of going to work, going errands and all that, and they cut it to 250, the price doubles and your usage goes down, you know, 10, even if it went down 10 or 15%. But I don't get the sense that most Americans have done that yet. Is it just a lag time until they actually react to the prices?
So a lot of people haven't done that yet, right? The question is how far up is it going to go? And we'll see about this. And the thing is like that you're hinting at, ultimately, is that inflation is not due, for the most part, to the war in Iraq. Yes, the war,
war in Ukraine. Yeah.
Yes. A few points have been added, but the bulk of the inflation is due to spending, to more spending, which inflated demand. So consumers can, you know, do some things by reducing their demand for pretty much everything. And people are doing this, right? I mean, there's evidence that consumers are actually not going out and buying stuff as much as they used to, in part because of high prices across the board, right? But the main work is going to have to be done by the Federal Reserve in the form of increasing interest rates, which is going to really depress the economy. I mean, how much is it going to depress the economy? I don't know, but it's going to have an impact. Unemployment is going to go up, and Congress needs to do the same thing by cutting spending. That's really what needs to happen, and you certainly shouldn't. You should stay away from the temptation to basically do type of Band-Aid policy, which takes 18 cents to a gallon. So basically, you can pretend, you can have sound bites pretending that inflation is all the fault of Putin to distract from the fact that actually your American rescue plan is more to blame than anything else for this mess.
Well, and Veronique, that's what I wish the government would do. When you see that, for instance, food stamps, welfare, and all the other social programs that were amped up during the pandemic, some states have actually done that. They said, we're going to put work requirements back in. You don't get Medicaid if you aren't satisfying the work requirements, you know, and you could do things like that that would take people off the rolls very quickly and very capably by doing their own work. But the government doesn't want to do that. Joe Biden certainly doesn't want to do that during an election year, does he?
No, he really doesn't. And he wants to really distract people from any responsibility he may have had. And let's not forget that we got actually saved by Senators Sinema and Manchin, who stopped even more spending from going through the economy when they blocked, with the help of the Republicans, the Build Back Better legislation, which could have spent, I think, I mean, it depends on the estimates, between $3 to $5 trillion, depending on how you measure it. And that would have been even more devastated. And so now, you know, like that's the real problem. The problem is that is like the Federal Reserve has made it possible to do all that. It's been really accommodating for all of the spending, and that's a real problem. That's the problem. But I mean, I saw a bunch of the quotes from President Biden this afternoon, and I was like, come on, man, seriously, even people on the left are saying, over the weekend, basically, there were some people really on the left were saying, another headline for this is how President Biden is going to make inflation worse. Even his own side is like, enough.
Enough is right. That's Veronique DeRougie from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, thank you. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. This segment of the show brought to you by Call 811 Before You Dig. Whether it's in your yard or in the field, it's the law. Call 811 to know what's below, or go to digsafelyoregon.com for the details of the Washington State equivalent as well. You can do it in Idaho, too. One of the hallmarks of this show that I established 25 years ago was naysayers go to the head of the line. Andy, if you're a naysayer, we must disagree about something today. What is it?
Hi, Lars. Well, actually, to tell you the truth, I don't disagree with you about much of anything. And also the as far as the Juneteenth, that's why I'm calling in the holiday that was yesterday in observance of Juneteenth, which was actually Sunday. But I couldn't help but notice you criticized the state and the federal government for making Monday, yesterday, a holiday and give all these workers the day off. You took the day off, too.
I can tell you why I did that. Because our flagship radio station recognizes it as a holiday for the workers. And I said, okay, I can either give them that day off or some other day. Fine. They got a long weekend, and that was that. And that's why I took the day off, because my crew, for the most part, can't take the day off unless I take the day off. But, you know, I've also explained I see no problem with Juneteenth as a recognition of one of the most consequential events in American history. I mean, we all know the Revolution was a consequential event. World Wars I and II were consequential events. And the Civil War was a consequential event. And one of the triggering causes, not just states' rights, but slavery and the Emancipation Proclamation declared by Lincoln, were hugely consequential events for America. So having a recognition of that is fine. Giving people a paid day off is something else. But as I said, when my crew, if I get the opportunity to give my crew a day off because they've got the day as a result of who we work for, then I do that. But I don't have a problem with the holiday itself. I do have a problem if they want to declare it America's new Independence Day, because there's a lot of politics tied up in that. But the cost, if there's a cost to giving people the day off yesterday or some other day, for those people I employ directly, the cost is on me, right? So at least I'm paying that cost. When the federal government, when the Congress says we're going to give government workers a day off, do they pay the cost, Andy, the members of Congress, or do we pay the cost?
Taxpayers.
Right.
Do.
So if I decide to give my workers something, you know, and pay for it out of my own pocket, I'm at least taking personal responsibility for that. When the government does it, when members of Congress say, let's vote everybody a brand new holiday with a day off with pay, they're handing out your cash and my cash. And I think there's a marked difference. Just like if Nike or Boeing or Microsoft or whoever gives everybody a paid day off on Juneteenth, at least it's a private company that incurs the cost. When it's the government doing it, it's the taxpayers paying the cost.
Lars, you've restored my faith in you again.
Well, and Andy, this one really does hit me. I'm a little ambivalent because, on one hand, should the day that the Emancipation Proclamation took 2 years to get to the most far-reaching corner of the country at the time, Galveston, Texas, it took 2 years. You know, these days it'd be there in 2 seconds on Twitter or something, or on Getter or Truth Social. But back then, and you say, well, did that kind of mark the end of that conflict in which 600,000 lives were lost, a major issue was resolved, the union was preserved? Yeah, we ought to recognize that. Does it mean everybody has to have a day off? No, not necessarily.
Agreed.
I mean, that's the way I take it. And this effort to try and say it's the new Independence Day really gets under my skin, because it's like, come on, we have an Independence Day. And Andy, I like to remind people, the only folks who benefit when we end up divided, right? So dividing people is saying Independence Day is 4th of July. No, it's Juneteenth. The minute you do that, you split America into camps. And do you know the only folks who benefit when the American people are split is politicians?
Well, I'm sick and tired of the woke crowd trying to change everything, all our traditions. It just disgusts me no end.
Oh, it does me as well, and what you said is significant. If somebody says, oh, you got to call people by the right pronouns, or you have to wave a rainbow flag or whatever, that is woke nonsense. If you said America is the only country on planet Earth that fought a consequential war, one that very easily could have ended with two different countries, and we ended the war, we preserved the union, the Emancipation Proclamation was declared by a Republican president, I might add. Most of the moves in civil rights have been made by Republican members of Congress, not by Democrats.
Yep.
They've been the party
That's
of slavery.
Right.
I'd even point out women voting was introduced by a Republican man. It was headed up by the suffragettes, who were almost entirely Republican women who pushed for that. And, you know, and when Jesse Owens went to the Olympics and showed Hitler what everything was all about, Who was the president who said, I won't even invite him to the White House? Well, that would have been FDR, the big hero of the Democrat Party. I don't think much of FDR. He was a full-blown bigot, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, we should recognize the significant events in American history, but we should resist the impulse to say we have two Independence Days and we have two national anthems and we have two flags or five flags or 12 flags or whatever it is. We have one flag. We have one pledge. We have one country. We have one people. And the minute people try to split you off and say you're black, you're white, you're Hispanic, you're male, you're female, you're gay, you're straight, all of those divisions benefit nobody except the political elites, and we ought to tell them to go pound sand. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits. At least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com.